welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Comedian, actor, activist, one-time American icon, Bill Cosby is serving a 3 to 10 year prison sentence at the State Correctional Institution at Phoenix in Montgomery County for drugging and sexually assaulting a woman in 2004. Proving a crime against the 81-year-old Cosby took almost a decade and a half and two trials. In the meantime, more than 60 women came forward to say Cosby had sexually assaulted or raped them. A book published just last week tells the story of how Cosby was finally brought to justice. It's called Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad. The book's author, Nicole Wisenseat Egan, joins us today. Ms. Egan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go back to 2004. Andrea Constand worked for Temple University in Philadelphia. She was the director of basketball operations. Bill Cosby may have been Temple's most famous alum. How did Andrea get to know Cosby, and what was her relationship?
She first met him in the fall, late fall of 2002. She had been at Temple for about a year, and Cosby was a huge supporter of the women's basketball team for which she was director of operations. He had even done some Comcast commercials and was friends with Dawn Staley, the coach. So Andrea was at a basketball game at the Leo Kors Center, and one of the donors to Temple introduced her to Cosby. After that, he started calling her, and he sort of took on this mentor role with her and was trying to encourage her to pursue sports broadcasting, which she had majored with in college, and you know was introducing her to people that could help her do that. And he was bringing her to New York to meet people and to Connecticut to meet people. And for a good year and a half, that was their relationship. Well, 15 months, that was their relationship. She viewed him as like a grandfatherly figure. I mean, he was actually older than her own father.
So it did change in 2004, though. What did Andrea accuse Cosby of doing?
What happened was she called him up, or they spoke, and she told him she was going to leave her job at Temple. She was in a career crisis and had decided to move back to Canada and go to massage school to be a masseuse like her dad. So he invited her over to his mansion in Cheltenham Township and asked her to come by and they could talk. And then when she got there, they talked for a little while, and she said she was stressed, and he said, "Oh, I have something to give you that'll help you relax." And he goes upstairs and comes back with three little blue pills, she said. And she said, "Are they herbal?" And he said, "Yes," because they had talked a lot through the time they'd known each other about alternative therapies like herbal medication, acupuncture, things like that. So she took it, and within 20 to 30 minutes, she could barely walk. Her vision was blurring, and he had to lead her over to the couch and lay her there. And she woke to find him molesting her, and she just was in and out of consciousness for months. And then she passed out again, and he was there waiting for her in a robe. And she ate a muffin, gave her a muffin, and then she left. And she just had no clue what happened to her. Her memory was spotty. She remembers him doing certain things to her, but there was just this disconnect. Like, how could he have done that? Because he would have had to have drugged her. Because she only had either a couple sips of wine or some water, not enough to do what was to have the effect this had on her. And she still had to deal with him because she still was working at Temple for a couple more months. And so she had to accept his phone calls and so forth for work-related reasons. And then she left at the end of March and moved back home to Canada.
And we'll talk about that in a moment because that did come up in Cosby's trials as to why Andrea contacted Cosby after this incident had occurred. Andrea told her mother about the assault in 2005, but she didn't go to police for a year. Why?
There were many, many reasons. She, because of Bill Cosby's power and prestige, she was struggling with what had happened to her. She still wasn't certain what he had done to her, what he had given her. But she came home a very different person, and her mom was really worried about her. She was withdrawn. She wasn't eating. She wasn't interacting with anybody. She was having nightmares where she would wake screaming in her sleep. Her mother could hear her from their bedroom. So she knew something was wrong with her. But and Andrea, was scared. Like, how do you do this? How do you come out and say that one of the most powerful men in the country and in Hollywood did this to you? And she was worried about repercussions for her and her family. But ultimately, what drove her to go to police was she kept having a dream that a woman was being sexually assaulted right in front of her, and she wasn't doing anything about it. And so she came forward because she was worried that he was going to do it to someone else.
You mentioned Andrea's mom, and she becomes an integral part of the story, too. Cosby not only had a relationship with, and by relationship, I'm meaning that, you know, a business relationship that he tried to take her on as a mentor, that kind of thing, but with the families as well. And I say the families because this was a pattern that he established, that often he would not only befriend the woman that he eventually sexually assaulted or was accused of sexually assaulting, but their families as well. And in Andrea's case, it was her mother. Her mother, after Andrea told her that Cosby had sexually molested her, got on the phone with Cosby. What was that conversation like?
She called him because she was so concerned because she didn't know. She wanted to know what drug he'd given her daughter. And because she had noticed how her daughter was such a changed woman when she came home. And so she called him and she left a message, and he called her back like 4 days later. And in the meantime, Andrea had gone to police. And so, yeah, she just demanded to know. She said, what did you give my daughter and how could you do it? Like, how could you give her something like that? How did you know she would wake up and that it wouldn't kill her, and so on and so forth? And so he said he would go upstairs and look at the prescription bottle and come back and tell her what it was. And instead, he went and looked, and he couldn't read it. So he said, I'll write it down on a piece of paper, and I'll tell you what it is. And then a couple days later, in the meantime, after that phone call, she went and got a recording device. And when they spoke again, because she was still bound and determined she was going to find out what drug he had given her daughter, she taped that conversation and just trying to get him to tell her what he gave the daughter.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We are speaking with Nicole Wisenzee Egan, author of the new book, Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad. And I should tell you that Nicole Wisenzee Egan appears at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg later today, 7 p.m. tonight. She'll be speaking with Kristen Hauser of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape. So if you have an opportunity to stop out at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Midtown Harrisburg, I'm sure you'll enjoy the conversation and learn a lot more from that conversation as well. We were talking about where Cosby and Andrea Konstad were in 2005. Montgomery County's district attorney at the time was Bruce Castor. He later became Pennsylvania's acting attorney general. Castor decided not to file charges against Cosby, saying there wasn't enough evidence. Now, I have to tell you, Ms. Egan, that Bruce Castor does not come off very well in your book.
Well, I have to tell you that it's the truth. I mean, if you'll notice, like when he just—it was clear he wanted nothing to do with this case from the beginning in 2005, which surprised me because I think I lay out very clearly what an incredible prosecutor he was. I mean, I'd seen him get murder convictions off of purely circumstantial cases. You know, once one based on just the imprint of a weapon in a holster. They didn't even have the murder weapon, and he got a conviction on it. That his office had prosecuted former Pennsylvania State Trooper Michael Evans, who had been accused of preying on dozens of women and girls. He had a drug-facilitated sexual assault case before. I found some quotes from him in one of my stories about it, where he says it's like using a weapon, having a drink, and having a drug and putting in someone's drink is like using a weapon or pointing a gun at someone. So I was really surprised by his whole attitude about the case from the beginning. And he loved high-profile cases. I mean, this is a guy who would hold a press conference for anything involved with his cases. But he just wanted nothing to do with this case from the beginning. And he just didn't. I mean, he cut short the investigation. The detectives in the case didn't even know he was closing the case. They were still in the middle of their investigation when he issued the press release he did.
Now, you speculate, but why do you think that Castor didn't want anything to do with it? Was it because of Cosby's fame, his power, just what?
You know, I still don't know. I really don't know. I know Andrea's attorneys have said they thought it was because he was going to run for office again. He had just lost that battle for attorney general the previous spring, when Drew Lewis and his wife had given him $600,000 in contributions. And Drew, of course, had been arrested for DUI, and the case was handled by Bruce's office. So,
and I should add that Drew Lewis, former Secretary of Transportation in the Reagan administration, and a powerful Republican.
Exactly, exactly. So Corbett had used that against him in the primary to say that Drew Lewis got special treatment, and that, you know, Castor should have recused himself from that case since they were friends. So he did still have political aspirations, but it's still a mystery to me. Honestly, it's still a mystery to me because he was a great prosecutor. I don't know why he did not want this case. And it, you know, Kevin Steele has shown you can be successful with cases like this, and they had before. That's what I said. They you know, with Michael Evans' case, only one person came to police. All the rest came forward after there was publicity about it. So this happens a lot. And by the time that case was going to a civil trial, there were 30 accusers. So and none of them had gone to police before. None of them. There was delayed reporting in almost all of them. So that's fairly common in sexual assault cases, and he knew that.
We're still in 2005. There started to be other women coming forward at the time. What were they saying about Cosby?
And that was interesting to me. So Bruce Castor did hold a press conference, and the comments he made were so concerning. A woman out in California, Tamara Green, an attorney, heard the excerpts from the conference, and she said to herself, that's DA speak for I'm not going to prosecute. She could just tell by the tone of Castor's comments that he wasn't going to prosecute Cosby, so she came forward because she said, because, you know, he did the same thing to me 30 years ago, and she came forward to support Andrea, basically, and say, I believe you're telling the truth because he did the same thing to me. And I got an exclusive with her. We ran on the cover, and then she subsequently did more media, and then 12 more women came forward and said he had done or tried to do similar things to them. But Castor's office didn't even bother to interview most of them.
You mentioned that it got a front page cover. You know, you said cover, Daily News, a little bit different front page than what many newspapers like the Philadelphia Inquirer, New York Times, Washington Post have a different kind of format. But you didn't get a lot of support. When I say you or the Daily News did not get a lot of support, even from the journalism community. Women, some of these women who had come forward, they were being interviewed, and it seemed like the interviewers were skeptical of their stories, or they were being grilled almost like they were on trial. What was going on there?
Right. They were doing that to me, too. I was being asked to be on a lot of these national TV programs, and I was getting attacked left and right as well. And there was a story in the local, in the Philly Weekly, attacking me and my newspaper for doing the stories. The rest of the media just backed completely off the story almost immediately. Cosby was either threatening them, these people kept threatening my newspaper as well, or they were promising them favors in some cases. I learned about a phrase called trading up then in the national media, and it was just about trading, backing up on one story to get a better one, because one of the bookers told me Cosby's people was giving them a very hard time because they were having me on the show. And pretty soon, guess what? I wasn't on the show anymore. And then he did that with the National Enquirer, because Beth Ferrier, one of the accusers, had gone to them with a story about him drugging and sexually assaulting her, and they killed her story in exchange for Cosby giving them an exclusive interview.
And one of the ironies of that is that Cosby had a past with the National Enquirer, and not a good one. So you write that it was surprising that Cosby went to the National Enquirer with an interview.
Right, because he had his choice of media outlets. I mean, legitimate ones.
Yeah.
And he could have gone anywhere with that interview. And when I first heard that, I was like, this does not make sense to me. Like, why go to the National Enquirer when you could go to mainstream media and go to the, you know, he could have had his pick. But he didn't. And then what was even odder to me was when I saw the coverage, there was a whole separate sidebar with Bill Cosby thanking them belatedly for offering the reward that caught his son's killer. Because he never had, they offered a $100,000 reward that led to the capture of Ennis's killer. And at that time, he and his wife were at war with the Enquirer, and they never thanked them. In fact, they were threatening to sue them for some of their coverage. Belatedly offering a thank you to the National Enquirer just stunk to high heaven to me, too. It made no sense.
Yes, Cosby's son, Ennis, was murdered while changing a tire, someone that had stopped along the road. Andrea settled her civil suit against Cosby in November 2006. That very well could have been the end of it. But a stand-up comedian by the name of Hannibal Buress called Cosby a rapist in his routine. And many things had to fall into place that reignited accusations against Cosby and brought attention to the case. And when I say many things had to fall in place, they really did. It was almost like a domino effect. Kind of explain what happened there.
Sure. So Hannibal Buress was appearing in Philadelphia, and at the last minute, Dan McQuaid, who was a writer for Philly Mag, someone offered him a ticket, so he decided to go. And he's sitting in the audience, and he, you know, is just kind of playing with his phone, and all of a sudden he hears the words Bill Cosby. So he perks up and he listens and he starts recording it with his iPhone, the video of it, because, you know, that's where Hannibal's talking about. Google Bill Cosby and rapist, you'll see it. And Hannibal, by the way, said he had been doing this routine on and off for like 6 months, so there was nothing new about it. He placed it on put it on the website the next afternoon, a Friday afternoon around 4, and it could have died there easily. But then over the weekend, a BuzzFeed reporter saw it on Facebook, and on Monday, she decided to write an aggregated story and reach out to see if anyone would comment, and they wouldn't. And then Gawker picked it up, because Gawker had just written about the cases back in February, so they were interested. And then the Daily Mail picked it up, and then it just started spiraling. But where it really went viral is on Twitter. And in 2005, Cosby was able to control the media very easily with threats or promises. In 2014, there was social media, and he couldn't control that because there was no Twitter in 2005. Facebook was just for college students. I mean, there was no social media, and the websites of news agencies were in their infancy, so stories really couldn't go viral. And they tried their best to control how everything was going on Twitter, and they couldn't. They had a meme contest that backfired because the memes became all about him drugging and sexually assaulting women. And it finally, and all these news online news organizations had sprung up in the meantime as well, and they were very aggressively covering the story, so much so that it finally forced the mainstream media to come in and start covering it. And then a bunch of them started doing mea culpas for not, because they had left, like Mark Whitaker had left it out of his book, had left the sexual assault accusations out of his book that had just
Mark Whitaker,
out.
What book was that?
It was a biography of Cosby. Okay. It came out right before this broke, like September of 2014. So they'd been doing interviews about that, and he left the sexual assault. It's a very good book. I've read it, and Cosby cooperated with it, but it says nothing about any of the sexual assault allegations from Andrea. There's nothing in there, and he started coming under fire for that. And then, like, David Carr at the New York Times wrote a mea culpa story about saying, I should have asked him about it. And a bunch of other journalists did the same thing. Even Ronan Farrow later said, you know, apologized for it in a column because he was with NBC then and was supposed to interview Cosby, but was told not to ask about that. So he only asked one quick question at the end.
So the media is kind of seeing the error of their ways. But back in 2005, when Andrea had first gone to police, there's women coming out, you wrote that the public wasn't angry. And that was one of the things that one of the reasons you point to as why Cosby was able to get away with it back in 2005, 2006, is because the public just didn't seem to, they didn't want to believe it, or they just weren't angry about it. Were they after the story went viral?
Yeah, some definitely, but there are still many who, you know, if you read the comments on some of these stories, there are still many that believe, don't believe the women. But I think what didn't help matters back then was Gloria Allred held a press conference after it blew up again with three of the women, and she called on Cosby to create a $100 million victim fund. And, you know, the women who were at that press conference, by the way, had no idea she was going to do that. And that immediately, and I write about this in the book, I'm like, that was just the worst thing to do, because Marty Singer's out there, they're all saying all these women are just out for money, and now you just handed that to them. And I can legitimately say they just want money, that's why they're saying this. So it really, it was a mixed bag. But I think that overall, like, people get, like, that many women saying the same thing, they've got to be telling the truth.
Marty Singer was an attorney for Cosby. Bruce Castor ran for Montgomery County District Attorney again in 2015 against Kevin Steele. Cosby became part of the campaign. Steele wins. What happens next?
Well, about 6 weeks later, on December 30th, 2015, Cosby's arrested. There was a 12-year statute of limitations on the charges that he was going to be charged with, so they had to arrest him before the end of the year, because mid-January, when they didn't have an exact date, was when Andrea said what happened to her happened. So, yeah, he was arrested, and he was charged with three counts of aggravated indecent assault.
But was Andrea's case the only one that fell under the statute of limitations?
Yes, of all the cases, it was the only one that fell under the statute of limitations, and still is. There's no other criminal cases out there. There are several civil lawsuits, but there's no other criminal case.
Speaking of civil cases, I mentioned that Andrea's civil suit against Cosby was settled in November 2006. One of the things that came out that had a great impact on public opinion as well as Cosby's subsequent trials, and that was the deposition that Cosby gave in the civil suit. Talk about the impact it had. What did he say that had this great impact?
I think the most shocking thing and what had the most impact that was in there was when he admitted to having 7 prescriptions for Quaaludes, and he gave it to, well, he first said women, and but then tried to correct it to say woman he wanted to have sex with. And I think that, and he admitted to affairs in the deposition. And I think that was just so shocking to people that, you know, it was easy to say all these women were lying, because he still had a lot of supporters, particularly African American celebrities, who were really doubting all these women who were coming forward, especially the drugging part, because he was Mr. Squeaky Clean. I mean, he's a guy who said he'd only had 3 drops of alcohol in his life. He tasted it and didn't like the loss of control, so he didn't. He lectured people about not using drugs. He had done a whole album in the early 70s warning kids about the dangers of drugs. There had never been a whisper of scandal around him other than what happened with Autumn Jackson, you know, when she blackmailed him saying he was her father. So it was, you know, hard for people to believe, but there he is in the deposition admitting that he at least was in possession of drugs and he gave them to women he wanted to have sex with. And I think it was just really shocking to people. And like Jill Scott was a prominent Philadelphian singer, and she really backed him initially when everything came out in 2014. But after that, you know, she tweeted just withdrawing it. She just said, no, I don't support him anymore. I believe this now.
So Cosby did go to trial in Montgomery County. That first trial, how would you describe it?
In what way?
Well, I mean, overall, when you look back on that first trial, what kind of feeling did you get about it? I mean, we on television, many of us saw Cosby coming in with a cane and someone on each arm. He claimed that he was blind. But the trial itself, what was the sense you got from that first trial?
Right. And let me say, all of a sudden, the black glasses and the cane appeared when he was arrested and he came to court to turn himself in. And I did see him, it appeared to be reading documents in court a couple of different times. So, I would say the mood, there was a lot of anticipation and excitement. The room was kind of buzzing. But as someone who knew the case so well, I didn't think the prosecution presented its case very well. And I thought that they let Andrea get attacked over and over without really defending her, and that they didn't answer some really key questions about her, like why let her answer, like why didn't you go to police for a year? You know, what was going on with you, and why are you here, and you know, who are you really now? Because you know, she's a masseuse that works with like cancer victims, and you know, Parkinson's. She's a very kind, gentle person, as I've come to see. I didn't know her at all, but I just knew of her. So, and Brian McMonagle is an incredible attorney, and he really did a masterful job. It was awful though, because it was watching a woman be attacked over and over again for the same things I'd seen happen with the Anita Hill case in 1991. You know, there were 100 and some phone calls. Why were you still in contact with him? You know, it was the same, and rape myths trotted out, right, you know, one after the other as if they were fact, and making a point of saying she wore like a shirt showing her midriff when she went over one night. It was the classic blame the victim, shame the victim strategy that a lot of defense attorneys use in sexual assault cases, and it worked.
Well, the jury was out for more than 50 hours. They couldn't reach a verdict, so the judge did declare a mistrial. Cosby was rearrested, and there was a second trial. This one was different, and the tone, the way you write about it in the book, the tone of this trial was much different. In fact, you point out that one of the best things that the prosecution did in this case was the very first witness was Dr. Barbara Ziv. She's a forensic psychologist who specializes in sex crimes. She was there to dispel many of the myths about sex crimes. You write that you were impressed.
Right. It was a really brilliant legal strategy that they used the second time around. And, of course, they they had the benefit of being able to go back and look at what they had done the first time to try to figure out what they did wrong. They had interviewed the jurors to try to get a sense of that as well, because they did have a sexual assault expert testify in the first trial, but she testified very late in the trial, and she also had had some like pro or anti-Cosby sentiments on her public Facebook page that they used against her. So it wasn't well. And the questioning of her was very specific to the case. And Pennsylvania was the last state in the nation to allow sexual assault experts to testify in court in these cases, and they're supposed to only talk in generalities. So that's not what she was doing. But this woman was amazing, and the questioning of her this time was great, too, because she just explained rape myth after rape myth, and, you know, like 85% of rapes are committed by someone that the person knows, they're not stranger rapes, that not fighting back is the norm, that keeping in contact is the norm with these cases, that it is the most underreported violent crime, that delayed reporting to authorities is the norm. And so she basically paved the way for, hey, this may seem strange to you and you're going to hear some really strange stuff, but this is quite normal for sexual assault cases. And then it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the 5 other women who testified, and then Andrea. And it was flawless. It was really well done, and it was very powerful to hear these stories one after the other.
Well, there was a common theme throughout those 5 women's testimony, and that was different than the first trial in that 5 women got to testify. What were some of the similarities?
He pursued for so many of them, he came to them wanting to be their mentor, and then he groomed them. He groomed their parents, and then when he got them in a place, in an environment that he controlled, there was this place in Nevada he used, in Reno, and then also at the Elvis Presley suite at the Las Vegas Hilton. That's where he drugged and sexually assaulted them. But first, he built a trusting relationship with them. And even the woman they had at the first trial was the same thing. She worked for his manager at William Morris, and he pursued her, was really advising her and trying to teach her how to act. And that's what this showed over and over. He came to all of them wanting to mentor them, and then he betrayed them.
He was found guilty this time on all 3 counts. You write that the jury in the second trial was very organized and very different than the first. In what ways?
Well, you could tell from the interviews from the jurors, the few jurors who spoke after the first trial, that it was very chaotic and unruly. That, you know, it was very emotional. That it sounded like they voted over and over again, and not just once. And at one point, one person got so upset that they punched a wall. Jurors who had quit smoking started smoking again. I mean, it was very contentious, and it was really stressful, and it was really awful. This was just very well organized. And, you know, I had never thought about this before, that jurors aren't told how to deliberate. You know, they're giving instructions by the judge, but nobody tells them, like, you go in the room and you're supposed to talk about this and then you vote, or you go in, like, nobody tells you how to do it. But the person they chose as their jury foreperson, too, was very organized, and they made a decision as a group very early on that they were going to work together and be very methodical about it. But first, you know, they'd been sequestered for a couple of weeks, but first they sort of had a free-for-all where they could talk about anything, because, of course, they weren't supposed to talk about the case at all until they got in that room. So there was a lot they wanted to say to each other first, and they just did that for a while. And then, you know, they started asking, you know, the couple of questions they had, and the first one was about consent. And the judge, you know, took us in court to say, you know, what is the legal definition of consent in Pennsylvania, and it turns out there isn't one, and so they couldn't apply it to this case.
Nicole Wise and C. Egan, we're almost out of time. What would you like readers to take away from this case? Or your book, I should say.
Well, I really hope that people read it to get a big picture look at how things like this happen, and because I also dig into why we always view sexual assault victims with so much suspicion, how icon intimidation, which is a term coined by a former FBI profiler in these cases, factors in, how it like blinds everybody around the person to what's going on. And it's a really deep look at how something like this can happen.
Nicole Wise and C. Egan is author of the new book, Chasing Cosby, The Downfall of America's Dad. She'll be appearing at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg later today at 7 p.m. Ms. Egan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. In March 1975, two sisters, Sheila and Kate Lyon, who were 12 and 10 years old, disappeared from a shopping mall in Maryland near Washington, D.C. They were never heard from again, and their bodies were never found. Police were frustrated as they worked on the case for years. Finally, in 2013, a break in the case. An inmate incarcerated in Delaware for child molestation was approached about his knowledge of a suspect in the case. The stories he told cracked the case more than 40 years later. Best-selling author Mark Bowden was a reporter for a Baltimore newspaper when the Lyon sisters were abducted. His new book, The Last Stone, tells the story starting in 1975 until someone ultimately pleaded guilty to the crimes. Mark Bowden has written 13 books, including the bestsellers Way 1968, Black Hawk Down, and Killing Pablo. Mark Bowden, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
Mark Bowden will appear at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg Saturday, May 4th at 6 p.m. A bit of a disclaimer here. This book is graphic, and some of what you will hear today may be disturbing. Mark Bowden, why did you want to write this book?
Well, I had covered this story. It was actually the first big story, Scott, that I ever covered as a reporter. And because it ended with no answers, it haunted me really my whole life as an unsolved mystery, but also as a sort of cautionary tale about what can happen when you let your children out the door. I ended up raising five of my own, and I never really lost my memory of the mystery of the Lyon sisters. So when I found out there had been a break, I really felt compelled to try to learn what had happened.
Tell me about Sheila and Kate Lyon and their family.
Well, the Lyon family was a very, I guess, successful small Catholic family in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. John was a prominent radio personality in Washington. They had two daughters and two sons, and they were ordinary and, attractive in every way. This tragedy kind of like came out of nowhere.
What do we know that happened to them in 1975?
Well, we know that Mary gave her daughters permission to walk down the street to the Wheaton Plaza Mall to buy a slice of pizza. This was in the afternoon, and they were expected back for dinner, which was not unusual in those days. I remember my mother sending my brothers and sisters and I out the door after breakfast and saying, don't come back until lunchtime. People felt a whole lot more comfortable that their neighborhoods were safe. And so when the girls failed to come back for dinner, the parents were first miffed at them for not returning or not calling, and then they began to worry, and then that worry turned into panic.
The book centers on Lloyd Lee Welch. How would you describe Lloyd Welch in 1975?
Lloyd was a member of a really awful family from the hills of West Virginia who had relocated to Hyattsville, Maryland, and they brought with them their country accent, their sort of outlaw attitude toward authority, and definitely sort of out of step with the mainstream of suburbia. But beyond that, they brought with them a family culture of sexual predation, where parents preyed on children, uncles raped nieces and nephews, older cousins raped younger ones, siblings experimented with each other sexually. So it was a very sordid and bizarre family culture out of which Lloyd emerged. And he was thrown out of his family basically at a very young age, lived as an orphan, or rather as a in foster homes, and then, but he kept running away. But by age 18, he had become a hardened kind of street personality, somebody who had to scrounged for food every day and was taking all kinds of drugs, and he was not your typical 18-year-old suburban boy.
A week after the Lyon sisters went missing, Welch showed up at the mall. He went to a security guard to say that he had seen the girls leave with a man who he described. Now, that security guard sent him to police. Welch told his story and actually took a polygraph test, which showed that he was not being truthful. The police thought that Lloyd Welch was a crackpot, and they sent him on his way. Now, that interview with police in 1975 got their attention in 2013 because he said that the man that he had seen with the girls walked with a limp. The police went to see him in Delaware. Talk about that first meeting with Lloyd Welch.
Well, they drove down to the prison. First of all, when they decided they were going to try to find Lloyd Welch again, they were surprised to find that he was already in prison for child molestation. So they arranged to interview him primarily to see if he could give them, if he could corroborate for them the person who they regarded as their primary suspect, who was a man named Ray Molesky who walked with a limp. But the more they talked to Lloyd, the more they began to realize that he sounded more like a suspect than a witness.
Now, this book is, it's truly unique because it follows interviews with Welch and the various stories that he tells. And quite frankly, it's almost difficult to keep track of the stories because he tells so many of them. They change so often. But it may be the only way to fully tell this story. And as I said, it is so unique. What made you decide on this format? And maybe you can describe the format of just following Lloyd Welch and the interviews with him.
Well, the reason that, Scott, that I decided to write this book is that this story merged two longstanding interests of mine. One is the mystery of the Lion Sisters, and the other is an interest in the methods and stratagems of interrogation, which is something I've written about in the past. And so this case, because it is built around an extended interrogation that took place over 2 years of multiple meetings, gave me an opportunity to watch and listen to interrogators or these detectives as they did this. And it was a seemingly impossible task, as you say, because I find it hard to come to get to the truth when the people I'm interviewing are trying to remember and trying to tell me the truth. Imagine doing it when the person you're interviewing is consistently trying to mislead you. And when every time you prove them wrong, they just shift ground and tell a completely different story. So the only way to tell this story, it seemed to me, was to get inside that interrogation room and go through that experience in the way that the detectives did.
And Welch, it's funny you say that, tell a totally different story. Often he would tell a totally different story and just disregard what he had told the police just moments before.
That's right. I mean, to Lloyd, there is no interest whatsoever in the truth. Everything he tells you is calculated to further whatever scam he is engaged in. In this case, he was trying to protect himself. But I think that unlike most people who, when they're caught in a lie, experience at least a moment of shame, Lloyd doesn't. I mean, he is so detached from any standard of truth-telling that when caught in a lie, he just smoothly moves on to a whole new ground, as if he had never told the earlier story.
Throughout the book, we get to know the police who were doing the interrogators. They all had their own characteristics, their own methodology. How would you describe those police? Who were they, and how would you describe them when they're interviewing Welch?
Well, they were three experienced criminal detectives in the Montgomery County, Maryland Police Department. Dave Davis was known as the department's premier interviewer or interrogator, and he has a very likable manner. He doesn't come off as a cop, and he was the guy who could make a criminal defendant feel like he was their friend, and that it was in their best interest to let him help them by getting them to tell him the truth. As one of the other detectives said, Dave is very genuine, even when he's not being genuine. Katie Leggett was a veteran of the sex crimes unit, and her approach to interrogation was to play upon the subject's conscience, which was very difficult in this case because Lloyd didn't have one. But Katie also came up with a couple of very clever ruses that tricked Lloyd into believing things that weren't true, and that ultimately led to some really interesting breakthroughs. Mark Janney, who is the third primary detective, is a former high school former college basketball player, and he's a big, intimidating guy, and he uses that to his advantage. So he was the person who Lloyd most disliked talking to, and he was the one who would always confront Lloyd with the lies that he had told.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. During this portion of the program, we're speaking with Mark Boughton, best-selling author Mark Boughton. His latest book is The Last Stone. Mark Boughton will appear at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg this Saturday, May 4th at 6 p.m. You know, Mark, from the very beginning of the book, one can assume or at least have strong suspicions that Lloyd Welch was the kidnapper and the murderer. But he kept telling stories that changed but cast blame elsewhere. What were some of the stories, some of the highlights? I mean, there are too many to go into detail, but what were some of the highlights of his stories that changed?
Well, one of the big ones was at a certain point, after initially saying he knew nothing and had been nowhere, had never been to the Wheaton Plaza Mall in his life, he eventually came around to saying that he had been there, but that it had been his cousin, Thomas Welch Jr., known as Teddy. That Teddy was the one who had kidnapped the girls and raped them and killed them, and that he had always been afraid to reveal this because he was so afraid of Teddy. It turned out, you know, Lloyd had been in prison for a long time and has been estranged from his family for a long time, and his math is not too good, because it turned out that Teddy was only 11 years old when this happened. And so the detectives would confront him with this and say, you were that afraid? He was 18 at the time. You were that afraid of your 11-year-old cousin? And he said, oh yeah, he was a really nasty character. But it clearly had been a lie. And so he shifted gears, and then he blamed another member of his family. But each of the people he blamed, there was at least a shred of possibility that it was true. And in the case of Teddy, it really took the police quite a while to, even though he had only been 11 years old, it took them quite a while to finally conclude that Teddy had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, Teddy had kind of, well, like everyone in this family, had a little bit of a different background. What was it?
Right. Well, Ted had been removed from his home because his father had molested and beaten him, and he fought back, and he ended up in a foster home, and he ran away. And he was picked up at age 13 by a middle-aged pederast named Leonard Crisell, who essentially adopted him as his lover when Teddy was just 13 years old. And he lived with this man for about 10 years. Lloyd knew that Ted, his cousin, had had this bizarre relationship with a child molester, and he knew that that would intrigue the detectives enough that they would take their suspicions of Teddy seriously. Teddy, you know, eventually broke off the sexual relationship with Leonard Crisell, but they remained friends, family friends, and Crisell bought a house for Teddy and his wife and set him up in business, and then ended up molesting Teddy's two boys, and he is now in prison for that.
As you said earlier, this is a strange family. In fact, I think you used the word awful. Lloyd Welch would try to cast blame on other family members other than his cousin Teddy, the 11-year-old who he was so afraid of. His Uncle Dickie. Tell me about Uncle Dickie.
Well, Uncle Dickie was the person who Lloyd swore was the real brains behind the operation. And he also was a plausible suspect, because as the detectives investigated Dick, they learned that there were his daughter, his nieces, all claimed to have been sexually molested by Dick when they were young. So that put him in the category of someone who could conceivably have been involved with kidnapping the Lyons girls. Dick is still alive, and he very effectively has denied any involvement in this throughout, and there's never been sufficient evidence to charge him with anything, so he has to be presumed innocent. But, you know, when Lloyd would throw out various family members as suspects, it was done with a measure of calculation, because he knew that the detectives would find the suspect intriguing.
when you say calculation, I think of, when we hear that word, it sounds as if there is some intelligence. This person has some intelligence, is smart. Is Lloyd Welch, or was he during this interrogation, this series of interrogation over a series of years, was he smart?
Without a doubt. He's a smart guy. He thinks he's smarter than he is, but he is smart. The people he was dealing with were far more determined and definitely as smart as he was. But, you know, someone like Lloyd, who has spent much of his adult life now in prison, has no education. He has a poor sense of situation. He doesn't, I think, have a good grasp of the way he appears to other people. And as we've talked about, his ability to slide from one lie to the next, which he will do without any real understanding that it makes him increasingly suspicious. He attracted their suspicion by being such a fluent liar, and I don't think it occurred to him that that would happen.
You could point the whole case being solved to him going back to the mall a week after the girls were taken. What he had in mind, you have several theories of what he had in mind, but if he hadn't have done that, he may be walking the streets today. I don't know. He may still be imprisoned in Delaware. But the case ultimately moves to Virginia. What happened in Virginia?
Well, Virginia is where, it turns out, Lloyd drove the bodies of these girls to dispose of them. And he drove to a family compound. I remember I said this family comes from the hills of West Virginia, family compound at a place called Thaxton, Virginia, where he still had a fairly large and extended family. So the investigation turned to Virginia, where the detectives found relatives who remembered Lloyd showing up with these duffel bags filled with bloody remains. They didn't know, or said they didn't know, that it was these little girls, but there were a couple. One of his cousins helped him throw the bags on the fire. So this became essential corroborative evidence that he had, in fact, killed them.
Yeah, he claimed that there was the body of a dead dog in these duffel bags.
Right.
And the police actually went back to where these bonfires had occurred, where they had been burned. They found very little evidence. They did find a human bone, but they were never able to tie it to either of the Lyon sisters, correct?
Right. They did find some tantalizing physical evidence, but nothing conclusive. But the most important thing they found were the stories that were told by Lloyd's cousins, Connie and Henry.
Finally, the truth did come out, but not the full truth of what happened to the girls. The detectives, the police who investigated the case and did the interviewing, have their own theories. What are some of those theories of what actually happened to the Lyon girls?
Well, the one thing that they all agree on is that Lloyd was the primary actor in kidnapping the girls and in, you know, what happened to them subsequently. Now, who helped him? Did he need any help? Did he do this alone? These are where the detectives have different theories, which range from a circle of child molesters who sort of coerced Lloyd or recruited Lloyd to help them with this crime. Others believe that there were members of his family, like his father, who's now deceased, or his uncle Dick, who were helpful in the crime. Some still, one of them, Chris Homrock, still believes that the original suspect which led them to Lloyd Welch, Ray Molesky, was somehow involved. So each of them has their own theory.
Mm. So in the book, you describe how Welch eventually pleaded guilty, that there wasn't a trial, which left some dissatisfaction because the whole truth didn't come out. Where is he now?
He's in prison in Smyrna, Delaware, where he'll serve out the remainder of his sentence for the original child molesting charge. And then this conviction will send him then to prison in Virginia, where he will be locked up for the rest of his life.
He basically traded the death penalty for going that guilty plea and going to jail for the rest of his life.
Right. He was not prepared to risk the death penalty, so he pleaded guilty in order to be guaranteed a sentence of life, basically.
The new book is The Last Stone by Mark Bowden. Mark Bowden will be at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg this Saturday, May 4th at 6 p.m. Mark Bowden, always good to talk with you.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.